It doesn't matter what I say. It doesn't matter what you say. Now it's too late. We have no organization. We have nothing, guys. Nothing. So now, shut your mouth.
Hello and welcome to the Sound of Football podcast. I'm Graham Sibley, and as ever, I'm joined by Jan Bilton.
Hello.
And Terry DeFellin.
Hello.
Yes, we're all back for another week of early season chat. Yes, plenty of stories changing as we go. Terry, we had a good chat last week about how rubbish Man United are. How foolish do we look now?
Pretty foolish, it's got to be said, yes. Within minutes, our takes were, well, colder than Antarctica. They really were.
They were so cold. They were so cold, our takes, weren't they? That you had to wear gloves or else you got frostbite on the end of your fingers if you tried picking them up.
Like liquid nitrogen ticks.
Yes. That's how cold they were. Our takes were so cold, you could use them to make super semiconductors. That's how cold they were.
Yes, they used them to simulate life on Mars. We sent them over to NASA.
They were so cold, they brought down the rate at which the Earth's climate was accelerating for just a week.
You're welcome, humanity. You're welcome.
So, yeah, you escaped there, Jan. You didn't show yourself up. But, hey, that's the nature of football, you see. You put your opinions out there only for football to come and prove you wrong. And that's why we love the game, isn't it, Jan?
It is. The football gods are fickle, aren't they?
They are.
Yes, you can't anger the football gods.
Also, this week, that's actually a bit of a special one, and it's worth celebrating as well, because this week marks 10 years since Jan joined us on the podcast. It's a bit a little sad because it's 10 years since Chris left as well. So Chris emigrated to New Zealand, and the guy that Terry and I went to football with every week very kindly agreed to sit in the empty chair that we had on the podcast. And we must be doing something right because he's still here. So he must still be enjoying it, despite what he says every week to the contrary.
No, it's been great to be here. It's I don't know who Chris is. He clearly wasn't as good as me because I've done longer. But it's been great. I can't believe it's 10 years. And I said that when you said you've done 100 episodes. God knows when that was. So, yeah, I was genuinely surprised when you told me that I'd done a decade. Yeah, not a bad innings.
No.
Were you surprised in a kind of post-match interview landmark kind of way? Well, Harry, that was your 250th goal. And how's it feel? Or was it? Oh, I had no idea.
Yeah, exactly like that.
What's important is that we got the 3 points, I suppose. Yeah.
Exactly. It's about the team. It's not about me.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah, that's what we all say. Mm. Yeah. We don't believe it really comes out of our own mouths. But, of course, over the last 10 years, it's almost impossible to pick out highlights or your favourite moments. But what really stands out for you, Jan? What really stands out for you when you think about what you've done on the podcast over the last 10 years?
I think some of the recordings that a conversation we had that stood out was the let's get rid of referees if we're going to rely on technology so much. That was a brilliant. I deliberately don't listen to that back because you should never go back, as we know, never go back. But that was quite good. Some of the ones that we did with Chris, actually, when he came back for a bit, I think you were away on holiday. I think we bought a football club in a supermarket. Do you remember that, Terry? We were constructing that. That was quite a good one. I think my favourite one was really down to your production skills, Graham, when we had the conversation which involved Eric fucking Gates, and you beautifully beeped out all of the swear words, which weren't really there, listeners, but certainly listen back to that one. That was very funny, but that's more down to your skill than my input.
Well, thank you. But every year we do have a chance to celebrate your boyhood club, Sunderland, the club of, as you can probably tell from Jan's accent, he comes from the northeast and is a lifelong fan of Sunderland. And every year we've had an opportunity to revisit your club because it seems like every year it comes earlier and earlier. But we have our own little episode that is really looking at who is going to be the next manager of Sunderland. And I'm just saying, I mean, it doesn't seem like, 9 months ago since we last had one. It's not even that, is it? I think it's six, isn't it?
It is six, yes. It was in February, March time when we last discussed it. It comes around fast every year, doesn't it? It seems like it comes around so quickly.
Now it's like the Queen's birthday. Like, we've got like two of them a year now, haven't we? So I just... Oof.
Yeah, what's we've happening? Really stepped up our game on this, haven't we? Really stepped up the game. I mean, across this 10-year period, you could argue that Chelsea really were the team you should have been talking about with the frequency in which they changed their managers. But actually, you know, we've done a really good job keeping, you know, Sunderland within the nation's narrative because of the mad way that we go through our managers.
Yeah, it was the news on Saturday that Alex Neil has decided to leave Sunderland.
It was Friday.
It started to come out on Friday.
Yeah. So his press conference was due to take place late morning, lunchtime, something like that. That was put back to 2 o'clock and then just didn't happen. Apparently he was on his way over to the Potteries to speak to Stoke. Stoke, who we'd beaten the week before 1-0, so I don't know whether there was a conversation had there, but certainly it all accelerated leading up to the match, the games on Saturday. He didn't turn up for the Sunderland game at home against Norwich. He was in the crowd at the Stoke City game, so and the Sunderland have since confirmed that he's left. But yeah, strange circumstances around it. So for those of you who don't know, Alex Neil replaced Lee Johnson in February last year. Lee Johnson, who was doing very, very well, but had endured a run of poor results. And he stepped in on that. And between then and the end of the season, where we were ultimately promoted in the playoffs, he lost just one game. So he had a huge effect on that group of players. And that shouldn't ever be forgotten, in my view. But yes, his head was turned, it seems, or maybe the club didn't do enough to keep him, and off he's gone.
It was a weird circumstance. As you say, he did so well in there in that closing part of the season, getting through the playoffs, but he wasn't offered a new contract, wasn't he? He was on a one-year rolling contract, wasn't he?
Well, see, this is probably something we're never going to find out, because apparently, what the club did release, Christian Speakman, who's our director of football, issued a statement on either Friday late or Saturday morning saying that as part of his contract, we have to let him speak to another club. And he signed improved terms at the beginning of the season, which maybe suggests that this rolling contract that's been talked about, this one-year rolling deal, was the improved contract. Now, whether that's all the club were willing to offer or that's what he wanted, I suppose we'll never know. And ultimately, I think a counteroffer was presented to him when he decided he wanted to speak to Stoke, which clearly wasn't enough. So there's a few scenarios that may or may not prove to be correct here. Either he's a mercenary, which is certainly what Sunderland Twitter is going with in a big way, certainly was in the hours after his move, or it's just a better deal for him and his family. And, you know, he wants to move on and make a bit more money, and maybe he thinks he can do a bit better there. Or the hierarchy at Sunderland, and I'm kind of leaning on this because this is the most Sunderland thing a Sunderland club can do, which is, and I say that a lot, just didn't get it right. So if you've got someone you've brought in, I think he took over from a manager that laid a really good foundation, and he made that better. He felt like he got the fans. He felt like he got the players going. He brought in youth and he got the experienced players playing again. And it just felt like it clicked. And that culminated in that wonderful, wonderful day when we got promoted at Wembley. And if that was me, I would have blown the doors off with any deal, because it just felt like that was going right. And it felt like, you know, he's got the experience with Preston and with Norwich. So he's done the championship before. So why wouldn't he be the guy, given what he's already done, to stay at the club and hopefully do something decent in the championship? And by decent, from my point of view, that could have just been, you know, lower mid-table would have been just splendid. But I suppose what makes this so much more disappointing is that we started really, really well. And it felt like we were just ready to crack on. And I think that the club need to possibly look at themselves here, because this shouldn't have been something that come up. If you've got someone who you think is good, unless they thought he wasn't, then you would tie them down to a deal. You'd want to keep hold of your best people. You want that in any way of life, don't you? If you own a business, if you own a football club, you want to tie the best people down to ensure continued success. And my take on it is that didn't happen, and this shouldn't have been something that even entered his head. So you know, there's talk that he wasn't backed in the transfer market. That may well be the case from his point of view. I'm not quite sure because it seems like we're still close on a couple of decent signings, and we tied down some really good players to contracts. But, you know, what's going on in his head, I don't know. But all I can see is that he was on a rolling contract. He was allowed to speak to other clubs within that contract, and the counteroffer that we went back with wasn't enough. So that tells me the club didn't work hard enough to keep him happy initially. And clearly the counteroffer wasn't enough to turn his head, which is another thing that I think needs looking at.
What about replacements? Who do you think, obviously the same old tired names are coming out again and again, but who do you think you would like to see in the role? Tony Mowbray, I think, is the leading name, isn't he?
When we spoke about this briefly on Saturday, he emerged as a favourite. I've kind of rolled my eyes and thought, oh my God, this is going to be awful. But actually doing a bit of reading up on him today shows my ignorance, because, you know, he did about 200 odd games as Blackburn manager, and apparently had a good reputation for bringing through young talent, stabilising the club. They wanted to go in a different direction. So it did make me think on that, but he is almost evens at the bookmakers. There's Sean Dyche, who's available. I think he'd be great because I think that would bring solidity. He's got, you know, he did 10 years at Burnley. All right, in the last season, it didn't go so well for him. You know, I think he would do a job for us. And there's other names in the mix. Anthony Barry, who I hadn't heard of until the bookmakers put his name on there. He's a coach at Chelsea in Belgium. And then there's Liam Manning, who's doing a great job at Milton Keynes, which that might be quite interesting. He's got a 53% win ratio, which is pretty good if you want to crack on. And Michael Carrick's in there. But Chris Wilder is also another name. I don't know why Michael Carrick's in there. I can't just leave that out there, can I? No. Michael Carrick, like, but, you know, that's a bit laziness. He's clearly looking for a management role. But Chris Wilder's in there as well. So if it was me, it'd be a toss-up between Chris Wilder and Sean Dyche, but I wouldn't be too disappointed if it was Liam Manning. But the names that are not in that list that are, here's one I'm not disappointed by, Neil Warnock, who said he'll come out of retirement to save Sunderland. Well, Neil, if you're listening, don't worry about it, mate. It's okay. You enjoy your retirement. You enjoy your golf and stay away from my club. But Big Sam is not in that list. I think anybody who's ever listened to me on the pod will know how much I love Big Sam and Bielsa, but that's a bit of a pipe dream for me.
Terry, Tony Mowbray, he did a great job at West Brom as well, didn't he, when he brought them up? They were a really good side, playing really good football when they came up, but it didn't work out so well when they were in the top flight. But that's not actually a bad shout, is it, for Sunderland? I think he's certainly someone who could get them out of the Championship upwards rather than downwards.
Yeah, well, unless there's any kind of residue of resentment or difficulty, because he's obviously quite strongly associated with Middlesbrough, which, as we know, are Sunderland's massive, biggest rivals, as we've discussed plenty of times on this podcast before.
Massive local rivals.
But take that out. It's his work that he's done at Blackburn that I think is probably the most impressive. It's a shame. Obviously, he won't be around to take advantage of any of the success that may come Blackburn's way under John Dale Thomason, because of the work that he done. He very quietly got on with the job there in what was an extremely troubled football club for many years, and he brought stability and he brought results and he brought football. He made Brereton Diaz a Chilean international. I mean, that is an achievement. So he demonstrates that he can bring players on and work with players and nurture them and improve them. And that is what Sunderland clearly need at the moment, because although Kirill Louis-Dreyfus is a millionaire, possibly a billionaire, you know, he's not the kind of guy who's just going to throw his cash around, not while they're in the Championship. Maybe if they get promoted to the Premier League, he might. But at this point, I think he's being much more cautious than that. And Sunderland need a coach who can improve players and someone who's got tons of experience. And I would say actually that Tony Mowbray probably is the most sensible choice. I'd be intrigued to see what Liam Manning did, but I think the inexperience is a bit of a risk at this stage of the season. And with Sunderland back in the Championship after a while having to get back up here, I think there's more at stake now. They were still a League One club. I think it'd be a different story. But as a Championship club, I think they've got more to lose. There's a lot more at stake. They need a safer pair of hands. I personally think Sean Dyche is waiting for a Premier League gig. Otherwise, he might actually be the actual Stoke manager rather than Alex Neil.
Yeah, I reckon Sean Dyche is perhaps waiting for the soon-to-be-vacant Aston Villa job. Because Steven Gerrard, he's not going to survive very long there, is he? Is he, Jan? He's not going to be there very long.
That was a flock of seagulls.
The seagulls.
turn your radio off, Terry.
The seagulls agree with that sentiment too. They think Gerrard is toast.
Yeah, Steven Gerrard. I mean, he's not a football manager, is he? He says he won the title in Scotland with Rangers, but I mean, like, we've only got his word for that, haven't we?
Yeah, he lost to West Ham, which, I mean, from my point of view, is unforgivable given who their manager is. There's a lovely symmetry to these conversations, isn't there? Coming back. And they got beaten off Palace as well, didn't they? And lost on opening day. So, I mean, it is a bit early to be chucking them out, I think. They've got to give them a bit more time, I would say. Given what he achieved, allegedly, in Scotland.
I mean, he did do quite a good job with Rangers in Europe up until Rangers then getting to the final of the Europa League last season, going, oh, actually, maybe he could have done a better job at Europe as well. It is very difficult to assess the suitability of any coach when they have managed either of the two Old Firm clubs because of the, not unique, but of the special relationship that the Old Firm has with the rest of Scottish football. It's either one or the other. Rangers had been away from winning that title for some time and he finally delivered it. That's got to be worth something. Does that mean that you're good enough to manage a Premier League club by sort of like finally winning the title with Rangers? I'm not so certain. I don't think that they're going to let go of him just yet because he's super high profile. He's still a young manager. He feels like yesterday when he retired still, although it was a few years ago now, but it feels like it was yesterday when he retired. He's a huge profile, and I imagine that they've put an awful lot of money into Gerrard and an awful lot of emotional investment into Gerrard that I think that too many of them, is it Christian Perslow, who's the sporting director there or the managing director there, the guy who calls the shots basically at Villa, I think that there's reputational damage to be done at a higher level if they have to get rid of Steven Gerrard so soon after having hired him. But obviously results determine these things. And so maybe if they still haven't picked up any more points in the next two or three games, then it could well be that he will out. The worrying thing, I think, is obviously what happened with Tyrone Mings. I mean, what on earth is going on there for something like that to happen that suggests, you know, a lack of ability to manage relationships, particularly with senior members of his squad. And that is a worry. And Villa fans, I think, are right to be disgruntled. And yeah, we'll see.
Yeah, obviously, they could go out and win their next two games comfortably and make fools of us all again.
It's important to hedge these things. But yeah.
Their next two games, by the way, are away to Arsenal and then home to Manchester City.
Right.
So I'd suggest that isn't going to happen. But, you know, shall I just throw in a scoreline? Just for the hell of it.
Go for it.
And then, they're going to beat Arsenal 3-0.
Oh.
Because last time I did that, it actually happened.
Last time you did it, indeed, it did happen. Yes, Peter Blake on Twitter, at MathSafe, he thought it was very impressive, especially considering that we don't give predictions. But, let's hear what you actually said a couple of weeks ago. Well, we've got Man United are away to Brentford. How do you think that's going to go, Jan?
Massive banana skin, that.
For Brentford.
They did all right the weekend, didn't they? Didn't Brentford come back from 2-0 down to draw with Leicester?
Yeah.
It's probably a good time for them to play Manchester United and hopefully stick four past them.
Yeah, we don't make predictions on this podcast for this very reason, because unfortunately, you know, it causes imbalance. There's huge amounts of money suddenly move in the Far East. And then, you know, investigations are made. So we try not to do this. Jan, what were you thinking? For God's sake. How many times have I told you to be careful about this sort of thing?
Yeah, I know. But I was sitting next to a guy at a service station and I just said, look, I'm not saying I'm accepting this money. I'm just not comfortable with it being on the table. That's kind of what happened.
So luckily Liverpool's journey from being rubbish to being amazing again happened within the space of time between our podcasts. They went from losing to terrible Man United and then go and beat Bournemouth 9-0. I mean, you just can't trust anyone these days, can you, Terry? Narrative is moving too fast to make us look fools now these days, isn't it?
when it gets to what we're even we're looking foolish, then you know something's terribly, terribly wrong. It's got to be said, it is Bournemouth, and Bournemouth do look particularly ill-equipped for the Premier League season. But obviously, as I know from personal experience, a 9-0 hiding is not something that you easily recover from, being a Crystal Palace fan and being old enough to remember when we were thrashed 9-0 by Liverpool. But yeah, it did look like a classic case of a big club, you know, had a bad time and was working its issues out on an inferior opposition. And, you know, also in a very, very meaningful sense, I think that this was probably the first time that Roberto Firmino played well this season. And that, I think, has got a lot to do with it too. And momentum, you know, it's a bit like a bowler, isn't it? In a different context, you know, Liverpool might well have invoked some kind of unofficial mercy rule and sort of like stopped at halftime and gone, well, let's just control these guys. But given how difficult it is even this early in the season and how far back they are in the title race, which seems absurd to say with only what, 3 or 4 weeks gone, Liverpool need every advantage that they can get. And that includes goal difference. But on another day, I think that it might well be that they'd have stood fast at 5 and gone, right, we're not going to go anywhere. But they were clearly hungry to make up for lost time. Liverpool played really badly against Manchester United, but it's one of those games where that match was such a febrile environment. It was such a one-off occasion that Liverpool the players were completely unprepared for it. And that's, to be fair, that's on the coach. But it's a relatively rare to encounter that kind of environment. And then when you back it up, the fact that, yeah, they've had two disappointing draws against two mid-table teams, it sort of created perhaps a false narrative about Liverpool. In fact, they're not terrible. They just had a slow start to the season and got caught unawares by Manchester United. And, you know, I mean, very few people felt that Man United would play that well. I don't think anyone had thought that Ten Hag would have the guts to drop the players that he dropped. But I guess after Brentford, he thought, well, I can do what I like now, can't I? Because you guys are rubbish, so I'm dropping yous. And it all kind of, the stars aligned, really. And I think Liverpool were then, you know, in a position to bounce back, and they did so. But we'll see what happens in the coming weeks, because there's more football to play.
Yeah, I know old school football people, I'd say football men, but it's probably men. Old school football people will think narratives, just... Football's not about narrative. It's about getting out and playing a game of football. It's a simple game. You just have to like knock a leather ball into a big hole. That's all it's about. You come here with your narratives and storylines and things like that. But, you know, narrative is important these days, especially if you've got a big money documentary on some streaming platform to sell. And everybody's got one of those now. Everybody. And some clubs are starting on their third season of it. This is what the whole thing about the Alex Neil story, wasn't it? This was just to give a real killer first episode of the new series of Sunderland Till I Die, wasn't it, Jan?
Well, yes, because it turned out amongst all of this happening that there were TV cameras there from the production company that are making season 3 of Sunderland Till I Die, which potentially was their first day of filming, although we've played a few games already. But, I mean, it'll all come out, I suppose, when that, if that's ever released. But it makes you wonder whether it was engineered, you know? When you said about Ten Hag being able to select whoever he wanted after the 4-0 thrashing, I thought, you're making it sound like a false flag, almost like it was designed to be that way. And I'm just wondering, you know, has it stopped being a documentary about a club? In Sunderland's case, has it stopped being a documentary about a club going through, you know, the pains that it's been going through for the last couple of years? Or has this been written for us and Sunderland are just implementing it after a team of writers in California have put pen to paper and decided what would make a good episode? I don't know.
I mean, I wouldn't put it past them to provide sort of like, you know, interesting talking points and action points that would make good content. I can certainly see that. Having watched a couple of series, and I got 2 episodes into the latest series of the F1 Netflix documentary. The more I watch that, the more I think that that's all put up. Not that it's being scripted, but that it's that the participants are so aware of the fact that the cameras are there that it's almost governing their decisions because they know they're in some kind of drama. They're in some sort of TV drama series, albeit reality. And the danger about these documentaries is that they go from being documentaries or observational documentaries into being reality TV, which is a different genre of television. It's much more staged let's set up the components, let's set the scene and see what people do in those environments, rather than just like, let us just observe from afar what's going on. And I think that this is conceivably where these documentaries could end up taking us in the end. And like, why not? Because it is a game. Football is a game, right?
Yeah,
it's a game that people play. So why should the game just stop when you cross the white line back into the changing rooms? It's a very interesting development. I've not watched too many of these documentaries, but at some point I intend to sit, maybe over Christmas, I'm going to sit down and have a right old binge and watch the All or Nothings and stuff like that. And this Wrexham thing that seems to be attracting the attention of Disney Plus subscribers, which is bizarre in itself.
Well, that exactly proves your point there, Terry. I mean, this is more about being like the Kardashians than actually being a fly on the wall observation of how a football club works. I haven't seen any of the All or Nothing series, and as an Arsenal fan, I'm actually not interested at all in watching the current one. It's been there for weeks, and I thought, well, no, I'm not feeling like I'm missing out at all on watching it. But you're right, the Wrexham one has come along, and now all of a sudden we were talking about it. We were all in the car. We did our road trip down to the South Coast to go and watch AFC Whiteleaf play Wick in the FA Vars. And we were discussing the new Wrexham documentary. Well, one of our number was discussing it because his wife and daughter were at home watching it. They have no interest in football, but they wanted to watch this because of Ryan Reynolds, obviously. So now you've got a whole different thing now where people aren't watching it because they want to see something, that because they've got an interest in how a football club runs. Now it's got celebrity value as well, isn't it?
To Terry's point, that is making it more of a reality show. Because of that type of thing. If it does bring people into football that ordinarily wouldn't, especially women, which is a good thing, and families, you know, that's positive. But there's an episode that obviously listeners should go back and listen to when we talked about Wrexham being bought. But to buy a club, to make a TV show, and then just flog it on afterwards, well, it doesn't sit right with me. It doesn't sit right with me. The All or Nothing things are a bit different because they are, I mean, they are worth watching because they are a fly on the wall documentaries. And you do get the Manchester City one I found was really enjoyable. The Spurs one as well. But and I find it puzzling that you won't watch it when it's your own club, Graham. Very strange to me anyway. But yeah, so it is a bit odd, but no doubt I'll end up watching them all as I usually do.
Also, something else about the Wrexham deal, because they brought in Sean Harvey, didn't they, into the club to help out. And if you don't know who Sean Harvey is, he's the one who recommended bringing in B teams into the Football League Trophy. So, yeah, I can see why some Wrexham fans might think this is not as great as everyone assumes they would. No, I just have no interest in the All or Nothing thing. I just absolutely just doesn't fire anything in me to say, oh, I really want to see that. I really want to see Mikel Arteta doodling while he gives his halftime talks. I think that's probably why, because I'm not really that interested in post-match interviews either. They're the bits I usually skip through during Match of the Day when I watch match, because I don't watch Match of the Day live. Just so I can skip through all the post-match interviews, because they're awful. Terry, what do you think about the current state of documentaries?
Well, it's difficult to judge because I've just admitted that I've hardly watched any of them.
Yeah,
so could be sitting here like they could be. I have no doubt that they're really engaging and they're really interesting and they're really, really well made. I don't think that there'll be a time when everybody will be doing them. Absolutely everyone will be doing them. And they are part of the narrative. They're a companion piece to the actual football itself. And in some instances, people will actually find them more interesting, more compelling than the 22 guys kicking the ball around.
It's interesting you say it, because I think I found the documentaries that I have watched that I've got really involved with are ones about sports that I have no idea about or have very little interest in. Things like The Last Dance. Last year, I watched the 100-foot wave. It was a program about surfing. No interest in surfing. I haven't even seen Point Break. Terry has. He loves it. So it's one of his favourite films, that is.
You haven't seen Point Break, honest to God, man.
He's definitely seen Point Break. He loves it.
Everyone's seen Point Break. Even people who haven't seen Point Break have seen Point Break by osmosis. It just seeps into our collective culture. The interesting, because obviously the last Tour de France has had the Netflix treatment, that had a Netflix documentary team following them around. And Tour de France is well known for being utterly, utterly bonkers if you're part of the cavalcade. And it is a cavalcade that travels around the country for 3 weeks. Apparently, it is utterly exhausting, completely chaotic, absolute insanity, and will almost certainly make for splendid viewing, particularly if you have no interest in watching bike racing, particularly you, Jan, because you have no interest in watching any kind of racing from what I gather. And I understand that totally, because it's just a bunch of guys riding bikes for 100 kilometers. Why would that be interesting? And I'm not here to tell you different. But the stuff that goes on around it, as I say, the cavalcade, is of tremendous and profound interest. And this is the thing. I mean, like, these documentary series are going to be like the end of season VHSs and DVDs that we used to buy. So it won't be just all the goals and the few highlights. It'll be like what happened behind the scenes and all of that stuff. And there's a huge interest for it, massive interest for it, even if it is sanitized and sort of like approved and stuff like that. If it's not proper, unlike the Sutherland one, which is a proper, decent observational documentary, that stuff is good. That's good. The two seasons that they've done have been brilliant. But even if they is a bit more sanitized, that's the way to look at it. Just look at it like it was like your end of season DVD that you sort of like sit through as, oh, I can't wait to find out what happened with that kind of thing. And we should be against this, I think, because it feels like commercialization, feels like exploitation. It feels like, you know, too modern football-y. It just feels faux and lacking authenticity. And we should be against this. But strangely, I find it difficult to be against it. I just, you know, it's just adding to the hoopla and not doing any harm from what I can tell. So
I'm wondering, like, well, as you say, it's the hoopla, but when's the hoopla going to be absolutely drawn into it? When do we get the fly on the wall documentary of Sky Sports News? And especially of the transfer deadline day.
Oh man, I'd watch that all day.
Oh, I know you would, Jan. I know it would. Yeah, but no one would admit to watching it, would they? Everyone would watch it, but no one would say they did. Terry, you'd watch it, wouldn't you?
Yes, totally. I don't watch Sky Sports News anymore. I had to take myself off it. I had to stop watching Sky Sports News because it was unhealthy. But I definitely watched that. Last night, I watched the end of the La Liga coverage, and when they lining up the interviews for the post match games, you know, they will do things like they will cut to a guy who's got a cameraman who's focusing on the guy who's waiting to be interviewed. So they'll give you that sort of like behind the scenes snap, sort of like say, well, you know, it's not this seamless sort of like, you know, you've got the anchorman there. They say goodbye to the guy that they're interviewing, and then they welcome on another one. They'll do that. We had that at the end of the United game when Erik ten Hag went and did his interview where he used the F-bomb by mistake, probably got Sky in trouble with Ofcom for doing so. And they will do that. They then followed and tracked him as he was walking off with what I assume was probably the chief PR guy off there. These kind of little behind-the-scenes snippets are creeping into live coverage. Yeah. You know, it is genuinely compelling. And you know, I mean, if we're going to have like TV everywhere, then we might as well try our best to make it compelling. It all will end terribly in total, complete football apocalypse. But, you know, we can't do anything about that right now. We might as well just, you know, enjoy the ride, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it will wear itself out eventually. I mean, the TV companies and production companies are trying to exploit and leverage as much they can get out of football as they can. But there's so much of it out there now. There'll be more to come, as we've said. But, you know, you can't help thinking that there'll be a fly-in-the-wall documentary about the making of a fly-in-the-wall documentary. Which actually, I thought that'd be bloody brilliant. Just the chaos of a production company and a production team trying to follow around footballers. that wouldn't be half bad, actually.
I think what it is, what we're seeing is what we've known for years about this whole sort of sanitized approach to hearing from footballers and the information that we get fed anyway. All the information that gets down to journalists has been vetted so much. All of their social media accounts are run by people within the club, and so they should be, because otherwise all hell breaks loose. So there is this sort of faux level of narrative coming from the inside of the clubs that we love. But it's almost our demand for it that controls what we're actually fed. So if we stop asking for it, then we don't get it. But obviously people want it because they keep making more and more of these. So who are we to judge? Yes, it's faux. Yes, it's modern football. But if people want it, that's the way you want to consume football or any sport, then go for it. And yes, you're right, Jan, if it brings new people to the game, new people that will have different expectations of the game as well, then that's not a bad thing and we shouldn't be afraid of it. But of course, who knows what the future will bring. And yes, I agree with Terry. I think it is going to be more like the Kardashians than it's going to be gritty, fly-on-the-wall observations. That's just the nature of the beast, isn't it? But yeah, the fly-on-the-wall Sky Sports News one, especially around the transfer deadline day, I think that's, it writes itself, doesn't it? Almost. Almost. It might have a little bit of extra writing, you know, just to spice it up a bit, or not to spice it up, because they don't want to get in trouble that way again, do they?
No, indeed, yeah. Can't wait to see, you know, the inside Jim Wirt's dressing room as he's putting on his lemon yellow tie to go out there.
Bringing it back though to football in the real world, the transfer window does close this week, so hopefully there'll be some bonkers ones to talk about next week. Terry, what did you think about Alexander Isak going to Newcastle? Is he their Robinho?
No, because he has a totally different status. Alexander Isak is not. Robinho was a megastar, wasn't he, already? Yeah. He was already super famous and well-known when he moved to Manchester City. And that was what sort of like shocked everyone. It was this massive statement signing. It sort of like paved the way for what Manchester City were going to be. Isak is much more of a kind of, you know, Newcastle United signing, and I mean this in the strictly modern sense. I mean, since the takeover, they've developed their policy seems to be actually to sign sensible players that will improve the squad rather than statement signings that will say, this is where, you know, 5 years from now, we're going to be everywhere. And Newcastle have not taken that approach. And as much as I object to their ownership model, you have to say that the approach they're taking is actually very sensible. Whether or not Isak is the right guy for Newcastle, I'm intrigued by the decision to sign him. His build-up play is superb. He's extremely talented. He's a good pro. He's done a great job at Real Sociedad, but he's quite streaky. And sometimes his finishing lets him down. He's not, for me, a front-line striker. I mean, I think if he was, he probably would have left Sociedad maybe last season. I know he did get an injury last season, which may have stopped that from happening. But for me, he's a little bit too flaky. I watched him a few times when he was at Borussia Dortmund, because he came to Dortmund, you know, with a big fanfare as a teenager. And everyone was saying he was the next Zlatan, which of course is just to call a player the next anyone is just fatal. And he didn't live up to his potential at all, and they ended up moving him on. And he's done well to rescue his career. But I'm just wondering what their expectations are there. Because if they're looking for a deadly finisher, then I don't know whether or not they've got that. But obviously they think about these things far more than I do. And you have to assume that there's a plan there. So, yeah, but I mean, he is a good signing. Whether he's worth the money they paid for him or not, doesn't matter, because they did. But yeah, I mean, he should improve that team.
He might be making his debut there for Newcastle away to Liverpool. So that's a bit of a baptism of fire for him. So we've got a full list of fixtures coming up this week, because the fixtures just won't stop between now and the World Cup. It'll be football, football, football. Yes, we love it. Well, David Moyes doesn't, but hey, who cares? Who cares what David Moyes thinks?
Not me.
But what are we going to be watching next weekend, I wonder? Well, we've got a Merseyside derby, Everton-Liverpool. And if Liverpool are still in the rampant form they were in last week, it could be a long day for Frank Lampard, couldn't it, Terry? Or the way narratives have been changing, it could easily end up being... Yeah, well, yeah, what do you think? Do you think it's going to be 3-1 to Everton home win?
No, I think Liverpool are going to batter them. And I predict we'll be talking about Frank Lampard being ahead of the sack race in a few weeks' time, I think. Time he got found out.
Everton should have lost that game, shouldn't they? Their game against Brentford.
Yeah.
I think Brentford had them on toast, but didn't get the butter out.
Nah. Next weekend, though, this weekend coming, we do have an embargo buster as well. The Lionesses World Cup qualifier against Austria kicks off at 4:30, straight in the middle of the blackout. Terry, ITV are going to be showing football when the Premier League is playing.
Yes, how very, very exciting. But it's all cool because it's international football, which trumps the club game, and maybe even women's football does too. That should be an interesting game because, obviously, as we know, Austria are more than tasty these days. And we'll be interested to see how the Lionesses have prepared after having spent probably the last few weeks celebrating their win. So knowing Serena, she's got them in order, but we shall see. I wouldn't want to make a prediction on that.
No, I was at Old Trafford for Austria-England in the recent Euros, and Austria gave England a really decent game. So, yeah, if England aren't back down to earth by the time this game rolls around, it could mean that England's comfortable progress into the World Cup, which will happen anyway, may just have a little hiccup beforehand anyway. But it'll be good to see if there's any celebrations there for Ellen White and Jill Scott, who retired in the last week after a huge, important England careers as well. So we wish them the best of luck for whatever lies ahead for them. But Jan, you'll be looking at Reading v Stoke just to see how Alex Neil gets on at his new club.
Yeah, I'm really interested to see how he gets on. Yeah, I'm just wishing him well. And I'll look forward to writing a very balanced piece for you all to read.
And I, for one, can't wait for Man United Arsenal.
I'm sure you can't.
Yeah, well, I can't at the moment. I'm not getting too excited. 4 wins out of 4. Yes. I should be getting excited. But, you know, I'm trying to be quite calm, you know, keep my emotions in check. October is coming and October looks awful for us. But hey, enjoy it while it can. Yeah, I'll be celebrating like an idiot every time they win, even if Richard Keys doesn't like it. But if you want to see what games we pick this weekend and what we think about them, then get along to sofpodcast.com, click on the link for the weekend box set, and sign up. Sign up for the email, and it will be in your inbox on Friday lunchtime. Or you can read it on our blog. But that's all we have time for this week. So from me, Graham Sibley, from Jan Bilton, and from Terry DeFello, it's goodbye.
Goodbye.
Cut.
You can contact us through our website, sofpodcast.com, via Twitter, @soundoffootball, or on facebook.com/soundoffootball.
But I am currently negotiating with a production company for a Sound of Football All or Nothing. So if you get suddenly start getting followed around by a couple of blokes with a boom mic and a GoPro, then that's down to me, all right? It just act natural, okay?
Here's Jan warming up for a Sound of Football recording this Monday night with a couple of beers and some peanuts. Terry's having some chamomile tea.
Graham, if you wouldn't mind, next time you're watching Sky Sports News, you wouldn't mind just like swearing at the presenter, you know, randomly. Please, that'd be great.
Yeah, sure. I've got that.
Try
I've
and
got
that. Things.
Okay. Like what sort of level of swearing do you want? Do you want C-bombs?
F-bomb at the very, very highest, but I think everything, you know, anything below that. But definitely don't go C-bomb because obviously we've got to think about our rating, you know, and
sure.
Stuff like that.
Sure. Yeah.
I mean, you can always beep that out, can't you?
Yeah, you can. That's true, I suppose.
So you can go full Mike Bassett, England manager. If you really want to.
Fine. I'm there.